welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I wanted to let everybody know that my podcast has now gone video. As of yesterday, the posting of my Sensibly Speaking episode number 25 was filmed, videoed right here on camera. So Ruth and I are both on camera there doing the entire episode, and we'll be doing that from here on out as far as we know. And we interviewed Peter Boghossian yesterday, and that was awesome. We weren't sure who was going to come on. He came on. We had a great talk, and we had it all set up as to what we were going to talk about, and then he found out that I used to be a Scientologist. And things went pretty woo from there. So, but we had some really, really good talk. He, of course, is the author of a book called A Manual for Creating Atheists, and has talked quite a bit about skepticism and critical thinking, and he's a real good guy. So if you haven't seen that, I highly recommend you check it out. So let's get on with your questions. Anonimo Fiorentino. What is your opinion of Anonymous and Project Chanology? Have they been useful in disseminating the abuses of the church? Have you ever picketed with them? What advice would you give them? Thanks for all the work you do. It's excellent quality and, of course, compliment, as we say in Italy, for your book. Great read. I am waiting for the audio version so that I can listen to it again whilst gardening. I probably butchered your compliment there. Sorry. I have the highest regard for Anonymous and what was done back in 2007, 2008, when they really got rolling on the protests and demonstrations against Scientology. I've watched documentaries about what happened, and I have, you know, some friends on Facebook and in life who are members of Anonymous or part of that, you know, that whole group of people. And I, you know, I really think that what they did was groundbreaking in a way that no other group could have done what they did. And the way their protests, when they arranged their mass protests against Scientology, they just cold-cocked the Church of Scientology. There was no defense for what Anonymous brought at them. And it was awesome. It really, really was. Inside the world of Scientology, you know, we were annoyed and irritated and this and that and exasperated and, you know, after all, you know, because protests went on and on and on, but it really made a difference. It really did. I wouldn't have thought that it was going to make a difference when I was in. I was just, oh, these guys, you know. But seeing what happened after I got out and seeing the effect it actually had on me, when I was still in. I mean, I was sitting there trying to brush it off and now this is just annoying and whatever. But those signs they were carrying around and the amount of times they kept coming back and making noise about how ridiculous and kind of evil Scientology was made it so that the repetition of the message kept it coming through and kept it real and kept it alive. And it was a big deal. It was a real big deal. I have never picketed with Anonymous, and I don't know that I ever will. I'm not a picketer or a demonstrator. I don't choose to protest in that way. I've given advice on, you know, what I think might be good to write on some of the signs and the ways to go about it, because rational discourse and non-antagonistic confrontation is best, you know. Definitely, like, without question, because all you do when you antagonize somebody outside their church of Scientology is you straighten their back and you get them pissed and upset, and that was not what appealed to me or got me thinking or planted seeds when I was in. So that's the, you know, I'm speaking from my own experience when I talk about that. In other words, The fact that protesters were out there and that they had signs and that they were committed and that they cared and that they seemed to actually have some empathy for the people, for us, inside the church, that's what mattered to me. That's what made a difference to me. them yelling and screaming and us yelling and screaming back or ignoring, having to ignore them and all that kind of stuff, that was not effective to me. That didn't, that was just, that was very ineffective as far as I was concerned. So, so that's kind of, my take on that. I cannot thank them enough for what they did, because it was, it definitely made a difference in terms of getting me out, you know, and I think it made a difference in getting a lot of people out of, you know, questioning the cult mindset and eventually leading us out of it. It's not like, you know, anybody walked by and saw the protest and were like, oh, Scientology, I'm not doing it anymore. You know, give me a sign. That's not that's not what happened, but it planted seeds, and that's really important. And as far as any advice I might have for them, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to, you know, presume to give Anonymous advice on what to do, because they came along before I did. Except please continue. You know, I think that that their demonstrations and whatnot are effective. I think there's one coming up next month. I'm very much looking forward to seeing what happens with that. And very much in support of that, and I hope that people will, you know, go out and be part of that. And I don't know, you know, maybe I actually would consider being part of that particular activity on that particular day. I do, you know, maybe that might not be such a bad idea, actually, now that I think about it. Yeah, so that's my take on them. James Ackerman. Hello, Chris. I've been watching your videos for a couple of years now and have recently read your book. Needless to say, I found the information you provide about Scientology and destructive cults very interesting and very useful. I want to pose a hypothetical scenario to you where Scientology had either taken over or formed its own city-state, or maybe even its own country. I want to know how you would think such a society would be run and organized, how it would interact with the global community, what its transportation system would be, etc. I ask because I've read and watched things that suggest that Hubbard had once tried to do something like this with Rhodesia, but more importantly, because I wanted to hear how you think Hubbard's management, study, and ethics technology would look like if applied on a much larger scale than at present. Thanks, and keep up the good work. I've never really given this whole thing much thought, but I guess that I think it would look a lot like North Korea. And I've said that before, of course, and I gathered that from Mike Rinder, who actually is the first person I know of who, or that I can recall, who made that comparison. I also think it might look quite a bit like Nazi Germany. And, you know, the Scientologists are not outwards. I know that some Scientologists or people who are pro-Scientology or something like that might think that's really, really offensive. But I don't mean it to be offensive. I don't say that because I'm making a joke or trying to degrade Scientologists. It's the fact that Scientology is an authoritarian system. And it is a high control group that engages in real thought control and thought stopping techniques in order to forward its message and keep people involved with it. So you have things like the Office of Special Affairs, which is akin to or analogous to the Gestapo. And you have things like disconnection and shunning. That is a destructive practice. It is thought stopping and thought control to run that on people. You are either with us or you are against us. It's black and white. And if you're going to run, if you think about what would it look like if a city or a country operated that way, well, look at North Korea, right? Here you have a country where you have a leader who is analogous to David Miscavige in many ways, both, you know, height, attitude, arrogance, you know, that sort of thing. He's kind of this little bully. And when you look at the political situation in North Korea, you understand that he kind of has to posture and has to make himself puffed up and look much more dangerous than he actually is. Because he's surrounded by countries, you know, or very near countries who are really dangerous, right? Who really do have military might. So there's that aspect of it. But don't get me wrong. I'm not justifying, you know, this guy's, you know, arrogance or insanity, or the way that they treat their citizens, right? This sort of false veneer the lies that have to be told to the citizens and to the rest of the world in order to continue a totalitarian regime like that are never anything else but destructive to its citizenry. So if you're gonna, you know, and then you have, like, for example, you have the Nazis, right? Lots of propaganda would be the order of the day. There would be failing systems, failing administrative systems, failing management systems, because Hubbard's management technology does not work. It is not a viable system. And if it were, Scientology organizations would be expanding and successful and prosperous. They are the epitome of what it is to be run by Scientology administrative procedures. I mean, I did a whole video about what's wrong with the Scientology hierarchy, the whole, you know, command system, and I laid out the command chart and I showed in detail why it is that that does not work. And, you know, and it was a long video because it had to be, because I had to explain the whole thing. So I'll refer to that video and I'll put a link to it in the notes below on this video. But that is Hubbard's management system. So if you imagine that on a government-wide scale, it's much worse than even the bureaucracy of the United States or any, you know, the bureaucracies tend to be very unwieldy. Their very nature makes them so. But Hubbard's system of the organizing board and all that sort of thing is not a solution to that problem. It just doesn't work. So they would try to use it, find it doesn't work, fill holes, have to, you know, make do with sticky tape and that sort of thing in order to make the thing operate. And you'd have a lot of people who were being told and who had to say, this system is the best system ever, and this is the system that is just the most wonderful thing and it's going to save the world. And yet they have to go to work every day knowing that it's not the best system in the world. It's not working. It's not producing viability or expansion or prosperity. It requires a lot of modification in order for it to work. So if you know, you have Hubbard's way, and then you have the things you have to do to make Hubbard's systems work, right? That's management. And also, you know, when you bring in the heavy totalitarian ethics system on top of that, now you're punishing people for having independent thought or creative ideas or trying to fix this thing. And then if they complain about it, or actually, you know, have freedom of expression, then they get slapped down, right? Because you have this whole reporting system where, with knowledge reports, where people have to write up and report to ethics officers, and ethics officers have to walk around inspecting everybody and looking, and they kind of play a bit of an SS role, you know, or the KGB, right? You have these secret police systems. So we already know what those systems would look like, and we already know the results of those systems. They fail. They fail every single time because people are not going to be living under authoritarian regimes for very long. The USSR didn't last a century, you know, and that was a horrible, horrible system, right? People just have a natural inclination to fight against that. They want to express themselves. They want to be creative. They want to have a voice. They want to be part of something. And when that thing that they're trying to be part of keeps pushing them down into the, you know, into the ground and you know, or killing people, things like that, those the leaders of those groups and those systems don't last. And that is why I don't think Scientology will ever expand to the point where it's going to even be a threat of a city-state or a nation or anything like that, because they're too bonkers. You know, it's really the bottom line. And they're too self-destructive, you know. Their organizations don't last. Their systems don't work. So the whole thing is just sort of doomed from the beginning. And again, also, as I've laid out in my videos, the system of Scientology itself has destruction, its own destruction, built into its DNA. So that's my take on that. Juni Hiltunen. Chris, are Scientology orgs able to do budgeting or financial planning? Yeah, every week. Every Church of Scientology has its executives meet every week, and they do what's called financial planning. They have a meeting, and it's called financial planning, or FP. And they decide, based on the week's income, where that week is going to go, where the money's going to go from that week. There are certain percentages that are sent up to management. Those are called payments to flag, or payment management payments. And those percentages come right off the top, and they get sent up. And there's a person in the church, the flag banking officer, who's usually a Sea Org member, and his job is to take that money and shuttle it up, right? And of course, if they have to pay their rent, and they, and all the money they've made is all they've got to pay the rent, then of course all of it goes to the rent. But management gets really pissed when they don't get their percentages. So generally those percentages come off, and then the org has to figure out how they're going to make up the money. And it becomes this, total rat race sort of horrible thing when they're not making enough money. When they do make enough money, pay the rent, pay the bills, then they figure out, the management payments have gone up, then they have the rest, and that goes to the staff pay, and also to expenses, like paper and stuff for the classrooms, and build a new addition to the building or whatever, all the stuff that is going to get done, or money gets set aside if they need to. They have some big project they want to do, like a renovations project or something, then the money gets set aside in a savings account for that project, right? Now, with the whole ideal org thing going on, they're doing this massive amount of fundraising to buy new buildings and renovate those buildings. That money is a whole different thing. That money is not allocated in the weekly financial planning. That's a different set of money. So when I'm talking about doing renovations on a building or something, that money is separately fundraised and is never part of this weekly allocation that the org does its financial planning around. Okay, so let's not confuse those two things. Generally speaking, with the amount of income that a Church of Scientology makes and the percentages that come off and that sort of thing, they're barely able to squeak by with paying their bills, paying the staff a tiny little amount of money, and paying their percentages, right? And as I've said before, the money goes up, it never comes back down, right? Very, very rarely will money come back down the line to the local churches in order to help them with some situation or problem something like that. And if it does have to come down, then there's hell to pay, and there's going to be a lot of consequences to that. So, in other words, the executives of that organization are going to get in a lot of trouble, and they're going to be subject to maybe being removed from their post, or they're going to be doing justice actions and whatnot internally in Scientology because they caused management to have to bail them out and pay money down the line to handle what they're supposed to be handling. Right? It's very, very iron fist when it comes to money in Scientology. They don't screw around at all when it comes to the money. So that's that. VSGL. Love your videos, very informative. Hypothetical. This month is the 30th anniversary of LRH's death. What would happen if someone under 30 walked into the main Church of Scientology building claiming they were LRH reincarnate? This is what Scientologists believe in, correct? Honestly, if somebody did that, they'd be shown the door very quickly. No one in Scientology is going to believe that anybody just walking in is going to be L. Ron Hubbard reincarnate. And that's really funny because they actually do believe in, coming back life after life after life and a cyclic aspect of existence. But they're not going to, believe that some schmo is L. Ron Hubbard or, you wouldn't believe how many people said they were L. Ron Hubbard's kid, said they were Arthur, or said they were, as well as, of course, famous people. I can't tell you how many Jesus Christs and Caesars and all this sort of thing I ran across in Scientology. So it's not unusual for people to claim to be famous people, but no one that I know of has ever claimed to be the old man himself. And, boy, that would just be really funny. But nobody in Scientology would really take somebody like that seriously. There was some kind of rumor that, maybe there's passwords or secret handshakes or something. That's all just a bunch of crap. Because when it comes down to it, David Miscavige is not at all interested in handing the reins over to somebody else who is or is not L. Ron Hubbard. Even if it really was L. Ron Hubbard who'd come back, David Miscavige still would not want to hand the reins back over to him. He'd just throw him in the gulag, you know. So I think that's pretty much what would happen in that case. And it's time for Flash Answers. CGY Punk. Did L. Ron Hubbard have something against dentists? Yeah, actually he did. Because according to a story Hubbard told, he almost died under the care of a dentist. I think it was in his 20s that that happened. And he had this whole out-of-body experience, and I actually talk about it in my book, because that's how he ended up writing a book called The One Command, or The Dark Sword, or Excalibur. And that was the forerunner to Dianetics and Scientology. And that all happened back in the 30s. So Hubbard definitely had a fear of dentists after that. And he didn't really talk about it. I'm assuming a little bit here. But as I understand it, yeah, he actually didn't like dentists at all. Grand Fabrica. Do you know whatever happened to Martin Samuels, the head of Cosmod and Delphi? That's the group I was involved in for years, and I never got the full story. Thanks. You know, I've been sitting on this question for quite a while because I have no idea, and I haven't found out. Martin Samuels is a name that has not crossed my path in the last 2 years or so that I've been speaking out about Scientology, and I guess I just didn't get interested enough to go research it or find out. So I really have absolutely no idea. Renewed Calm. Why does Scientology engage in bull baiting when they know it's just going to get on the internet and make them look stupid and evil? Are they just incapable of learning new tricks? Or do they think there's an intimidation benefit that outweighs the negative? I'm assuming by bull baiting you mean the stuff that goes on video where high-level Scientologists will confront, you know, like Marty Rathbun or Mike Rinder or something, and it gets on video and it gets up on the internet. That is, you know, bull baiting is where you're, you know, broaden the bowl, right? That sort of thing is stupid and evil, and it looks stupid and evil to anybody who watches it, but it's ordered by David Miscavige. He doesn't care if that sort of thing gets on the internet or not. He really doesn't have a thing on it, because it's his will. It's command intention, right? It's what he wants, and he's very used to having what he wants. So he orders people to go and do these intimidation and harassing and stalking tactics, and then they get on camera, and then they get on the internet, and guess who gets blamed? The people who went and did the harassment and the stalking are the ones who get blamed for having it go on camera and get on the internet, and it's all their fault, right? It's not Miscavige's fault, never Miscavige's fault. And then they, of course, accept the blame, and you know, then it goes round and round and round. So Miscavige definitely thinks that he's like a bully, you know, and he acts like a bully. And I'm talking about, like, you know, a third grader, like a bully. He doesn't think in long-term sort of, you know, consequences of this stuff getting out there and getting all over the internet and stuff. I think we'll see less and less and less of that sort of thing as time goes on, because it has had such negative consequences on the church. And of course all the critics now know that, you know, if they're confronted by, you know, some guy who's harassing and stalking them, definitely get the camera out, you know, and video that. I know I certainly would. So and I think that they kind of got the idea now, like sort of maybe that's not such a good thing to do. But Miscavige wouldn't hesitate to continue to have somebody, you know, harassed and whatnot, if that's what he wanted. He wouldn't have a problem with that. True Man Being. Hey Chris, in a video on YouTube called The Strange Case of Stephen Fishman, a man describes his beliefs in Scientology at length to his lawyers, and in one part he says that the term WOG originally meant Worthy Oriental Gentleman, which, as you've said before, was an old European derogatory term. However, he then says, but it also means the world operating genetically. That's the real definition. Have you ever heard that phrase while in the Sea Org? Moreover, do you think there are some principles of eugenics that are present in Scientology? That's what came to my mind when I heard that phrase. No, absolutely not. I never heard anything like that. I don't think that there's anything like eugenics going on in Scientology. In fact, Scientology specifically has literature through the Citizens Commission on Human Rights against eugenics. And I learned all about eugenics because I was reading the anti-psychiatry literature that was produced by the Church of Scientology. So, no, I don't think there's any of that going on. And this, this guy who was on Steve Fishman, he wasn't even a Scientologist. The guy was faking it. You know, he was never a high-level Scientologist. And world operating genetically doesn't make any sense. That's a term that makes no sense whatsoever to me. So, and certainly nothing I ever heard of when I was in Scientology. So, no and no. Melissa Brooklyn, did you have career goals while in the church? If so, what was your motivation to further these goals? The church, personal, or a combination? Thank you for your videos. I look forward to them each week. Thanks, Melissa. I had goals to be an auditor. That is actually what I wanted to do in Scientology, is I wanted to audit. I wanted to counsel other people because I thought that would be the best way to help people, you know? I was kind of into being an administrator and being an executive because I was helping a broad base of people, you know, more than one person at a time is sort of the idea that I had as an administrator. But in the end, I really did want to be an auditor. And that was something that I never was really going to be or was going to be allowed to be because I was actually pretty good at being an executive and an administrator and a leader type person, a person who could get other people to get things done and that sort of thing. I was actually kind of good at that. And so so they didn't want to have me go off of that or stop doing that work. And even when I asked a couple times, hey, I'd really like to go be an auditor. And it was like, yeah, no, not so much, you know, because then you're in a room and you're helping one person at a time and, you know, you could be doing so much more with what you're doing for us right now was always the attitude about it. So I thought it was a goal that was a good goal to have personally and for the organization, you know, but it really wasn't to be. And so we've come to the end of another episode of Critical Q&A. Thank you very much for coming around and watching. I really appreciate you, you know, listening to my answers and what I've had to say here. And if you have any questions at all, leave them in the comments section below and I will see them and I will get to them, hopefully eventually. And, of course, any other comments or feedback or anything you have, I very much would be interested in hearing that as well. And of course, you know, you can always throw me some love and support through my Patreon campaign. That would be very, very much appreciated. I recently made a video for my Patreon followers that kind of gave them a little bit of an inside scoop on some plans and whatnot that I have for this year, and I'm gonna try to keep that sort of thing going. So, you know, if you involve yourself in that, then you'll kind of have an inside line. So, anyway, thanks a lot, and I will see you guys next week.